This is an ABC podcast.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
If you went to school in the 1980s and 90s, you were probably taught about healthy eating via the food pyramid. It was back in the good old days when you seemed to be allowed to go hard on pasta and grains, although all fat was bad. But you don't see the food pyramid much these days. While the food pyramid was easy to understand, and it's not exactly wrong, it was oversimplified and didn't really provide insight into how food is grown or whether it's even been processed. But is our education around food in schools much better today? Good morning, Kirsten Diprose here with you for the Conversation Hour, filling in for Rochelle Hunt this week here on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria. Multiple surveys suggest many primary and high school students don't know where their food comes from. For instance, in Australia, a third of students don't know that yogurt comes from a cow, and that's according to research by the Primary Industries Education Foundation. So instead of food pyramids or good food versus bad food or talking to kids about what's in their lunchbox, should we be talking to students more about food systems? Will this enhance healthy eating in children? How do you talk to your kids about food?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Well, this morning, Australia's first and only food festival for kids, the Little Food Festival, kicked off today at Fed Square. And its founder and regular guest on this program, Dr. Sandra DeMayo, hopefully will be coming over straight from the festival a little bit later to join us in the studio, if he can get here quick enough. But here with me now in the studio, I'm very delighted to welcome Little Food Festival director, mum of two and nutrition graduate, Alira Taylor. Hi, Alira.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And also, I'd like to welcome Professor Dina Leahy, Associate Professor, School of Education, Culture and Society at Monash University. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks so much. It's great to be here.
It's delightful to both have you in the studio for this conversation. Alira, I'll start with you just about the festival. So, first of its kind, why should we have a festival for young children?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, the Little Food Festival is Australia's first and only festival created especially for kids. It's a free community event, and we need events like this to connect kids with the food system. And what the festival does is, I think it was founded back in 2018, so this is the sixth year of the festival, and the Sandro DeMayo Foundation started the festival together with Fed Square and Monash because there are lots of challenges with where the food system is currently at. So we know that Aussie kids don't consume the recommended amount of fruit and veg. And
yeah, I read somewhere that it was like only 5% consumed the right amount of fruit and veg. That's astounding.
It is. It's astounding. And the food system where it currently is at contributes a third of global greenhouse gas emissions. So it is concerning. But there's also lots of opportunities and ways we can improve the system as well by educating the next generation, getting them engaged. And that's what the festival is aiming to do.
Fantastic. And Professor Dina Leahy, we're talking about food system literacy here, really. Why is it important for kids to understand this, and how much can they understand? I mean, a lot of us have a hard time getting our heads around it.
Yeah, well, kids are quite remarkable, actually, and over the years we've kind of tried different evaluation methods to gauge what they understand, and I can talk about the findings from those evaluation methods a little bit later on, but certainly kids are really quite receptive to the messages, and we're talking about food systems because, as you said in the introduction, so much of food education in the past has really been about, you know, fairly about nutrition knowledges, about really simplified versions of how and why we eat. Whereas when we look at the challenges today, as Alira just talked about, we're looking at significant challenges related to the food system and how it contributes to climate change and to health more broadly. And so we need new approaches to food education. And so we've kind of, food literacy is a concept that gets used in the academic literature to measure kids' understandings and skills. So we're kind of adding another dimension to that and calling it food systems literacy and looking to see how we can help develop understandings around the food system. So from farm or from ocean or water through to plate and into the recycle, reuse.
What's the level of kids' literacy right now? Because, again, I read another survey saying that a lot of kids couldn't recognise a beetroot or a leek when they see it.
Yeah, and those, I mean, we hear those results, we've heard those results over time. They tend to be, and they kind of set off a response that people are alarmed. And it's no wonder when you look at the kinds of ways in which people eat and what they buy at the supermarkets. So that's where they think, we can ask kids where their food comes from, and they'll say from mum, or they'll say from the supermarket or from the shop. And so that's what they know that food is. And so one of the things we try and do, and Sandra is a real advocate for this, is to kind of connect kids back in with, you know, food as it's produced in a more rawer form.
This text message, hi there, being sheep farmers, our children and younger members of the family have a great understanding of where our food comes from, i.e. lamb, where it comes from. They get to see it born right up to slaughter. This gets the kids out on farms to teach them, and that's from Nick. I mean, a lot of kids don't have any access to farms at all.
No, that's the thing, and we're kind of seeing, as you know, more people move to urban areas, we don't, and also organisations or farmers struggling to kind of find out people who can come and work with them on the farms or take the farms over. We're losing that.
How hard is it to get kids on farms? Look, I know the VFF had a program recently about getting kids on farms, and there are pockets here and there that take city kids to the country, but it's really hard, I think. Just all the red tape can be really difficult. Any insights on that?
Oh, just to agree with you about the red tape, Dr. Rosie Welsh and I worked with a local government area group of people recently, and we were talking about how do we engage kids in schools with agriculture and with farming, and a lot of the people talked about just the amount of red tape and the issues around safety and disruption to the school day. So there are real barriers in place to actually do the work that we think needs to be done. And I think that's why the Little Food Festival's a lovely antidote to some of that. It's not the answer, but it's part of a response.
Text message. Just picking me up, yogurt actually comes from milk, not necessarily from a cow. Correct, yes. And I mean, sometimes it's plant-based these days too.
Yes.
I love it when our astute audience picks me up on these things. Alira Taylor, you're the Little Food Festival director, but you're also a mum. How do you talk to your children about food?
Yeah, I've got two little girls, 9 and 6. I've always been passionate about the food system. I studied nutrition and health promotion at university, but since becoming a parent, it's just elevated things much higher for me in terms of my passion with this. And I think, as all parents do, that you want to set your kids up with the tools they need to live a happy and healthy life. And I see the food system as the perfect way to do that. So it's about, from my perspective, setting them up for physical health with eating their fruit and veggies, of course, but also the food system gives them tools for mental and social health as well, in terms of sitting at the table, connecting with their friends and family, sharing a meal together, and also when they get in the garden and they understand how a fruit or veggie is created from a seed, and then it's just, you know, the power of Mother Nature. And if they're engaged in that magic, I believe that they will grow up and have the tools they need to protect the physical environment.
Well, let's bring in Dr. Kathy Wilkinson. She's the CEO of the Stephanie Alexander Kitchen Garden Foundation. So talking about getting kids in the garden and getting kids cooking. Hi, Kathy. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Wonderful to join you.
So we've got quite a few text messages as well talking about, yeah, getting kids out and getting their hands dirty. What does the Stephanie Alexander Kitchen Garden Foundation actually do?
So this year, actually, we're celebrating our 20th anniversary, which is very exciting. And Stephanie Alexander, 20 years ago, set the foundation up to bring kitchen garden programs into schools right across Australia. And what we do is we support schools and early childhood centres to set up kitchen garden programs, sort of following what we call a start small, dream big philosophy. So doesn't matter what a school has or an early childhood setting has at the moment, you can start somewhere. And what we do is then teach children how to grow, harvest, prepare and share fresh, delicious food together. And I guess really support that systems approach that everyone's talking about. For us, that's right across that grow, harvest, prepare, share continuum.
You talked about, I suppose it's really that sensory experience. How do kids connect with actually doing some of the practical things?
Yeah, that's right. So as soon as children get into the garden, as soon as they're digging in the dirt, they're, you know, counting the number of worms and snails, they're popping that seed in the dirt, they're watering it, they're seeing it grow, and then obviously when it comes harvest time, picking the fruit or the vegetables or the herbs, what that does is it gives a real sensory, practical, behavioural connection to those fruits, those vegetables, herbs, that they then take into the kitchen. And then another sensory, practical, positive approach takes on where they look at how they can prepare that into food that they then come and share together around that table. And Stephanie's always said that that sharing component, coming together around the table, is what then helps embed those positive memories around, yeah, positive food habits.
Yeah, food is cultural and social. I think we sometimes forget that.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, when we talk about the food system, it's a social system, it's an ecological system, it's a cultural system, it is an economic system, and building children and families and community understanding of that is just so important.
Dina Lay is nodding her head furiously. Do you have anything to add to that, Dina?
Oh, no, I was just in agreement, and I'm really quite familiar with the Stephanie Alexander Kitchen Garden program, and one of the things I really love about it is that the access to the sensory learning experience, and in particular, and Kathy, you might want to talk a little bit more about this, that's the kind of making food education fun and pleasurable food education, as opposed to that kind of really risk-based approach of if you eat that, you'll die or you'll get cardiovascular disease. You know, so we talk about health education, but often it's death education. It's all the ways you can die. And I think the Stephanie Alexander Garden Foundation are just fabulous because they do emphasise the pleasurable aspect of food.
Yeah, fabulous. And this text message, Kathy, I think you'll enjoy. Josh from Ascot Vale says, it sounds like parents need the education. What happens when a child isn't getting great education at home with food? And sometimes that's not, you know, because they're being neglected. It's just that we as parents might have been brought up differently and we might not be across the food system as well as we could be.
Yeah, look, as Dina said, one of Stephanie's amazing innovations right from the start was pleasurable food education, which is focused on that empowering children and young people to connect with delicious fresh food through fun hands-on learning. And what we know is that when children are getting access to that and being empowered with that sensory experience, those practical skills for life, and experiencing making the recipes, they take them home. And the number of stories we get from parents saying, oh my goodness, it's completely changed the food culture of our household, because the children have come home with recipes, confident in the kitchen, they might have got their knife license in grade 3, and then it begins to change that culture in the home.
A knife license, so that's about how to what, cut veggies?
Well, indeed, like how to safely use a knife. You know, I think sometimes we can overlook practical things like that. And so, yes, we've got a knife license system, and the pride with which the children sort of get their knife licenses is incredible. We all might remember getting our pen license at school. Well, here's the knife license, and it's incredible bringing adults into the kitchens and them watching the grade 3 and 4 year olds with the with these, you know, good knives, going, oh my gosh, but the children have been taught those practical skills so that they're very competent.
Oh, look, as a mum, the whole concept of your kids using knives, even though, you know, like it's age appropriate, obviously, but maybe we can be overprotective, I think, and perhaps not let our kids do things because we're so worried about, you know, them using a knife. I think about it now and go, ooh.
Yeah, that's right. It really is quite incredible. What comes to mind is I was at a school recently and you had all these year three students chopping up broccoli and broccolini to make a this amazing salad, and they were going for it, and the adults were all watching, very, very impressed. The fact that, you know, the broccoli or the whatever, the carrot, the tomato, the zucchini was from the garden that they've grown, then just adds to the richness of that experience and creates those memories for life.
A text message here saying, I grew up in a country town near the dairy that delivered our milk in bottles. My brother and I went to stay on a farm one weekend and the farmer milked the cow and gave us a glass of warm milk to drink. I remember bursting into tears and saying I didn't want it because at home our milk was cold and came from a bottle. That's an experience that, you know, a lot of kids have. Now you sort of can't even drink it sort of fresh from the cow because of, you know, the fear of it being contaminated.
Yeah, look, I'm happy to jump in there. My parents had an orchard in Batley, New South Wales. They grew apples, so that very direct experience, connection to farms, the understanding that fruit and veg, produce comes in all sorts of different sizes. I think building that flexibility in children to everything not coming standardised and so on is just so important.
Dr. Kathy Wilkinson, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Kathy Wilkinson is here, CEO, Stephanie Alexander Kitchen Garden Foundation. You're listening to The Conversation Hour. My name is Kirsten Diprose. Should we be talking more about food systems? How will this enhance healthy eating in children?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
And an important conversation about food and how we teach our kids about food. Still with me in the studio is Dina Lay, Associate Professor, School of Education, Culture and Society at Monash University, and Alira Taylor, Little Food Festival Director. And the Little Food Festival kicked off today, which is very exciting. What ages is it for, Alira?
Well, it's for all ages, but we do focus our educational messaging and our activities on the early primary school age, so about 5 to 12, but there's something there for everyone.
When we're talking to 5 to 12-year-olds, and Dina, you might be able to talk about this, and we're raising those kind of bigger issues around climate change or food insecurity and food systems, food waste, and we'll talk a bit about food waste in just a moment as well. How can you do that without scaring them?
Yeah, that's a good question. And as I said before, I think fear and fear-based tactics have been a really key part of health education and public health over time. But the food festival takes quite a different approach. And we kind of, you know, drawing on Kathy's and the Stephanie Alexander's kitchen garden idea of pleasurable food education, sensory food education, making it fun, but also simplifying the message and using a strengths-based approach where we work with kids to think about what it is they can do to make a little bit of change. And we don't kind of say, oh, if you don't make this change, the world's going to explode. But we talk about how the change could impact on their health, the community's health, but also the planet's health. And kids are quite aware of issues around the planet and climate change. And so they do connect with that work.
Is it about empowering them as well? Because as a kid, you can feel quite powerless. You don't have the ability to go out and make changes, or you feel like that. So how do you counter that?
I think one of the issues is often we do focus on what individuals can do, and part of what we do at the food festival is to, with the focus on food systems, is to kind of try and open up the conversation to think, well, actually there are multiple actors involved in the food system. And so the big, say for example, supermarkets, they contribute to the food system, and what do they do, for example, to kind of support better practices around food waste, for example. So whilst we focus on individuals and at younger ages, that's what we tend to do because that's kind of where they're at and where the messages will sit, we do want to be having conversations about what we can do differently and what other things actually do impact on the food system other than just us.
What about lunchboxes? And I raised it at the start because, you know, if it's not the food pyramid, it's then the lunchbox. What's in the lunchbox? Is this a helpful way of thinking about food?
I'm going to say no. In fact, you know, we do have some research that shows just the negative impact on lunchbox surveillance and what it has on kids and families. And there was a story, we did some research, it was led by Professor Jane Marie Maher at Monash University, looking at school food and children and families' experience of school food programs. And one of the students and mothers told a story about how she would send their daughter along to school every morning with a muesli bar in their lunchbox. And she found out after 6 or 7 weeks of being in grade prep that her daughter wasn't actually taking the muesli bar into the classroom. She was actually putting it in the garden because she was actually scared that the teacher would walk around the room and pick up the muesli bar and shame her for having a muesli bar in her lunchbox. And, I mean, I think teachers have all good intentions, but I think sometimes those sorts of activities, and particularly lunchbox surveillance, really does tend to shame certain people, certain families and certain bodies and certain food practices and is really not that helpful.
It's interesting you raise that because I've got primary school aged kids and sometimes there is that feeling of, oh gosh, if I put a little bit of the leftover chocolate cake from the birthday party, is this going to look bad? And I think, am I going to look like a bad mum who lets them eat cake? And then, look, I put it in anyway and I think, look, I know my children eat a pretty healthy diet. I know what they eat across the scheme of things.
Yeah, and that was like with the mothers that we talked to in that study I mentioned before, that was pretty much the sentiment. It's like, I actually know what my kids are eating. I know what they'll eat. And they were sometimes concerned that if they packed, say, for example, raw tomatoes and raw carrots, yeah, that it actually wouldn't get eaten and it would go into waste. And so in some ways they were sort of trying to mediate that, making sure that their child got to eat and also making sure that they weren't wasting money.
That's exactly right. And the thought of your kid running around hungry is awful as a parent. And you go, if I just pack celery, carrots and tomatoes, I might look like I've got the best lunchbox, but if they don't eat it, then they're not getting the fuel they need to learn. But just on that, so how do we get kids to eat the tomatoes and the carrots when you put them in their lunchbox and they don't get eaten? And you know what both my sons said to me yesterday, and they're at a vacation program while I'm here, and I said, oh, you didn't eat your apple. And they said, yeah, well, there was no fruit time. And I said, fruit time's any time, because at school they have a specific time for fruit, which is an interesting kind of, they kind of force them to eat it. But now my kids think if there's no fruit time, they don't eat the fruit.
Mm, yeah, that's an unintended consequence, I imagine, of that initiative in schools. Yeah, but
at my daughter's school, it's called brain food. So they have brain food time, which is lovely because it forces them to have a piece of fruit or a veggie to power their brains for learning, which is great. But yes, I have the same experience where my daughter will say, I didn't eat my apple because I didn't have any brain food time. So it's a tricky one, that one.
But I suppose that goes back to growing the food. And, you know, when the kids have grown the broccoli and they've cut it up and then they're eating it and they've garnished it and cooked it, as opposed to putting some raw broccoli in their lunchbox.
Yes. So my girls, if they grow their cherry tomatoes, they will treat them like a lolly.
Ooh.
And they will absolutely eat them. And they understand, they can taste the difference between a supermarket cherry tomato and a homegrown one. So that's a little tip there. Grow your own veggies and your kids will more than likely eat them because they'll be proud of themselves.
Wow, you've just you've raised the bar very high. Eating cherry tomatoes like a lolly, Alira Taylor. Thank you so much. All the best with the Little Food Festival. It's on again tomorrow as well as today during the day. Thank you so much for joining us here in the studio.
Thank you very much,
Alira Taylor, there, Little Food Festival director, mum of two, and nutrition graduate here on the Conversation Hour. You're listening to me, Kirsten Diprose, and joining us in the studio now is Dr. Sandra DeMayo. He is the CEO of Vic Health, a medical doctor, public health advocate, and friend and regular of this show.
Good to be back.
You've just bolted over from Fed Square into the ABC studios.
Yeah, there might be a few listeners who saw this frantic running man in a pink Little Food Festival volunteer t-shirt outside the Arts Centre about 10 minutes ago, sweating. it's a pleasure to join. Thank you for having me.
And Dina Leahy is still with us, Associate Professor of the School of Education, Culture and Society at Monash University. And we have been talking about moving away from the food pyramid. Mm. What was before the food pyramid? Does anyone know?
Well, we've gone through this incredible evolution over the last like 50 years as food science and kind of the medicine around food has evolved. And originally it was all about before the food pyramid, it was, you know, about kind of the different parts of our diet, carbohydrates and fats. And then we kind of found a way of making it easy to understand through this pyramid, you know, eat the most of the bottom, the least of the top. And then as science has developed, we've realized it's not quite that simple. And we've moved away from probably looking at calories or even individual nutrients like, you know, macronutrients like proteins or carbohydrates, to realizing it's much more about the whole food. And then increasingly, it's actually much more about the food system. So the latest dietary guidelines from Canada actually talk about eating food without a screen and eating food with other people, because there are actually mental and physical health benefits that come with that part. So it's not just about the food, it's about how we engage with the food, how we eat the food. As the more we understand about food, the social and psychological and health benefits, it becomes even more interesting.
Yeah, so the food system is even that social element of sitting down to have a meal together.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's really interesting.
And it's so important, because you realise that actually, you know, so for example, many of us will sit down, maybe we're watching TV or with our screens. It's very hard not to do. I find it hard to put my screen away at dinner time. But actually, when you look at the science, there are huge mental and physical health benefits of eating without a screen. And some of them might be obvious. You know, we are more likely to have a conversation. We're more likely to appreciate the food. We're more likely to be mindful and ask questions about where the food came from or appreciate the person who made it. But actually, there are all sorts of benefits that go beyond that, even for things like how much food we eat. So if you're distracted by your screen, you're more likely to eat more food than you need, which can lead to all sorts of health problems in the longer term. So, yeah, the more we understand about food, we realize it's not just about oils or fats. It's not just about, you know, sugar or calories or even the whole foods. It's about what we do with the food, how we interact with the food across the whole food system.
Given your public health messaging experience, how do you talk to kids or sort of message to kids about healthy eating and the food system without making them too worried about what they're putting into their bodies?
Yeah. Well, I think this is a really important question, and it's a hard one because parents want to talk about, you know, what's healthy, but then we say don't talk about healthy and not healthy or good and bad. You know, those types of words are often discouraged these days as well. I think really the evidence suggests, and this is why I love Stephanie Alexander's program, Oz Harvest's Feast program, and also the work that Dina does at Monash, really being, you know, being led by play. So letting kids play with the food, interact with the food, talking about the benefits that it will have, not necessarily to, you know, just health, but what Alira was talking about earlier, you know, this is great for our brain, this is great for our thinking, this is great for other aspects. But also, you know, talking about things like colours and textures. And so it's the, you know, making it as playful and interactive as possible and focusing less on necessarily even getting kids to eat everything the first time. Alice Zlasky, a good friend of yours and mine from the ABC, once told me, you know, it'll probably take 3 or 4 times of a child interacting with a new food for them to even start to really want to taste it. The first time they see it, they might, you know, poke it or throw it or squish it. And that's them starting to explore and use play to explore. As time goes on, though, they'll taste a little bit. They'll start to develop a palate. And, you know, I mean, easy for me to say, I'm an uncle, not a dad. So probably lots of people saying, you know, does this guy have kids?
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the theory. That's the theory. But love to hear from the listeners.
I remember as a child, my mother used to make us a big mound of mashed potato and inside it was, you know, bits of carrot,
Trojan horse.
Peas. And, oh, it was almost every night and it was yeah. a slog.
I had the same with lasagna, you know, all like love lasagna as a child, Italian child. But there were always veggies hidden in there. It was pretty clever of my nonna.
And Dino, you might have, you know, some thoughts on this too, but that concept of play with food rather than this is bad, I think as well because we don't want kids to worry about their bodies and about fat and being overweight. And we do hear kids, and it's awful when you hear a child talk negatively about their body and then think about the food in terms of their body. It's an awful thing to start thinking about when you're 8 or 9.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the research does show, and more recently we've had a special interest group who've actually looked at what the curriculum covers in relation to food and been asking questions about how those messages actually contribute to eating disordered practices and then eating disorders overall. And so we're actually having to go back to the drawing board and to think about what it is to actually encourage. For example, a classic activity in schools is to get kids to keep a food diary and then add up their calories or their kilojoules each day. And sometimes, because it brings in a maths element, you'll actually see those food diaries and those kilojoules mapped onto the board as a class graph and also BMIs.
Is that good? That sounds terrible.
No, it's a really problematic practice. But again, it's one of those practices. And the last 20 years, I would say, and Sarah, you're probably better positioned to talk about this than me, that there's been a huge emphasis on obesity prevention. And that kind of sort of kicked off and started impacting on schools sort of late 1990s, early 2000s. And one of the ways that teachers thought that they could actually contribute to prevention was to start to do all these really interactive cross-curricular activities. And that activity of, you know, doing your food diary and your BMI and putting it up on a chart would be seen to be good pedagogy. But there's another layer that we need to be thinking about in order to think, actually, that's really problematic.
Yeah.
And I think that's why, you know, you're absolutely right, Dina. And as we've understood more about the science and the implications of talking about certain aspects, I mean, even for adults being, you know, in the 80s and 90s, we were all about fat. It was all about getting fat out. And what we realized was we replaced the fat with sugar, and sugar was actually probably just as harmful, if not more harmful, to our long-term health. So I think rather than trying to talk about the latest macronutrient, what we're realizing is let's engage kids in talking about the food and the food system, where our food comes from, you know, what role do farmers have, what role does the soil have. We can still talk about, you know, we can still integrate maths, we can integrate chemistry, talking about phosphorus and nitrogen in the soil. We can talk about, you know, geography. There are all these different ways we can integrate the curriculum into food, but doing it in a much more strengths-based way that's exploring where our food comes from, what does seasonality mean, what difference does the distance that it travels make to the environment, to our health, and what difference does it make to eat together, to celebrate the cultures around the table, to understand our own ancestry and what our grandparents ate. All of these are really healthy conversations that we can be having around food that are so empowering and do make those connections in young people's minds between the food we eat, our health, our long-term health, been in a really strengths-based, playful way, the health of the environment and, of course, our culture as a community.
Dr. Sandra DeMeo is with us, CEO of Vic Health, and Dina Lahey from Monash University. Becky Orpen is with us down at Fed Square. She is at the Little Food Festival. Becky, we've been talking about playing with food and being creative, and you're an artist.
I am an artist, that's correct.
Tell us about the role that you have when it comes to food and this festival.
Well, I've put together a craft activity, which I've done for quite a few years now. It's one of my favourite festivals to work with. So we've done an activity which is based on seasonal produce this year. And so kids get to make a little paper basket and then choose from a selection of fruit and veg. And we've got a guide there as to, you know, choose a season and choose fruit and veg that are in that season to put in your basket.
Yeah, and this is a really great example as well of using food to, you know, develop so many aspects of a child's sort of cognitive and interpersonal development, nutrition, obviously, understanding. So what Becky's doing, Becky is, as always, being pretty modest. She's an amazing Melbourne-based artist, does beautiful work, really colourful, big, vibrant kind of work.
Did she do your shirt?
No, this is actually a Monash student that did it. But,
wow.
But, yeah, I'm wearing a Little Food Festival volunteer T-shirt. But you'll know Becky's work. You would have seen it. She's kind of an icon of Melbourne's art scene. And she's doing, what she's doing is really getting kids to use to explore what's in season, all the different colours of the different fruits, cut those out. So, you know, we're talking about what we're understanding, what grows when. We're talking about the rainbow of fruit. We're also developing, you know, their fine art skills, cutting things out, pasting things, and then they're building a little basket that they can take away. And, you know, Becky, it seemed when I left the square about 20 minutes ago, it seems like it's our busiest year yet. What's the reaction been from young kids coming in and engaging with you?
I think definitely very busy down here. Who doesn't love a free activity on the school holidays? But no, it's great. It's really busy. So I think one of the most appealing things is we do have a lot of the fruit and vegetables pre-cut to make it easy for kids. And actually it's the array of seeing all the fruit and veg sort of laid out with all the different colours, which I guess is really similar to when you do go to the grocery store or the market. So that's been the thing that the kids love to do most, is choose what fruit and veg they're going to put into their basket and sort of referencing the poster.
And Becky, you're also exploring some kind of culturally diverse fruits and vegetables too, aren't you? So there are kids kind of learning about probably fruits and vegetables that they've never seen before or interacted with before, and that kind of creates questions and conversations. Can you tell us about the kind of how you bring that cultural aspect in as well?
Yeah, so we definitely look, you know, include sort of Asian veg like gai lan, or sort of, I guess, fruits that aren't as, you know, an apple or a pear. We've also got pomegranates. We've also got plums. We've also got, you know, those type of things. And I've definitely had some conversations with kids this morning about what is gai lan and what is, you know, what is this shape vegetable and fruit. So that's really good too.
Well, Becky, we'll leave you to it. Thank you so much for stepping out and having a chat to us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Becky Orpen there. She's an artist and part of the Little Food Festival. Claire has called in from Ballarat. Hi, Claire.
I just wanted to talk about our local primary school. I'm one of three senior volunteers, and one afternoon a week we help just a small group of kids who are allocated to the program for mainly there's an indicator that something's not right, be it that they're suffering anxiety, there's they're new to the school, there's been a death in the family, a whole variety of reasons. And what I really love, so it's very much around mental health, because you see the kids within minutes. You see them sort of arrival tensed and anxious, and then you can just see them calm down. And so I love that association where that enjoyment and a lot of emphasis on teamwork as well. Mm. So the association with this fresh food is of relaxing, which I think is a really positive way to introduce healthy food. And watching these kids eat the cherry tomato lollies and nibbling on the beans and harvesting the food, you'd think, you know, it was the best thing in the whole world. That was squeals of delight. But you're going to love a comment, though. The last group we had, we're giving out the goodies and everyone's having a great time, you know, how many beans they're getting and all the different veggies. And one of them said, I don't want to take any home. And it's like, why do you want to take any home? Because mum will make me eat them.
So what can you, I mean, first of all, thank you for the volunteer work you do. So important across schools all throughout Victoria. Can you tell us a little bit more about the program? So the connection between food and mental health, what do the kids actually do with you?
So we just make it up on the day as to what's in season. We're getting more and more garden beds all the time, so we've got a large area to plant. Mm. So we just look at what's in season. So they might be harvesting, they might be getting a garden bed prepared, they might be sowing seeds, you know, it depends on the day. So it's just the whole variety, and just what I'm really hoping is when they get older that they have a memory of feeling good about themselves and feeling good about the world by growing veggies.
Thank you so much for calling in, Claire. You're listening to The Conversation Hour. Kirsten DePrez here with you, filling in for Rochelle Hunt. instead of food pyramids or good food versus bad food, should we be talking about food systems instead?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is the Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
And in the studio with me here on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria is Dr. Sandro De Mayo and Dr. Robin Alders, who's from Monash University. Sandro is, of course, the CEO of Vic Health. And I'd like to bring in another doctor. I don't have a title. Dr. Robin Alders, who's the honorary professor with the Development Policy Centre within the Australian National University. And Robin is also a farmer based in the New South Wales Southern Tablelands. Hi, Robin.
Hi, good morning.
Look, we've been talking a lot about education of food, but what about starting from where it all begins on the farm? Because it is so important for kids to, you know, grow their own veggies. I mean, we've been talking about gardening, but of course a lot of our food doesn't actually come to us that way. It's grown on commercial farms and goes into a supermarket.
That's very true. And indeed, what is offered to us through that system is what our economic system requires, which is something that's often large in volume, but not necessarily dense in terms of nutrients.
When it comes to our food system, why do we have the system that we have now?
Well, if we're going to talk about here in Australia, we have a very, as we know, a concentrated food system, but it does start with soil. And Australia has some of the oldest soils known across the world. But we do have a chance to work with those good soils to ensure that our plants are going to have a good nutrient profile, that the animals that eat those plants and the humans are going to feel better because the food that they're getting from products that come from that healthy soil really works through the whole system to carry that benefit of healthy soil, healthy plant, healthy animal and healthy humans.
There's been a shift in farming that's really just only sort of starting to take hold about the value of soil. I mean, farmers know how important soil is, but the soil to their nutrients of what they're growing. And look, some people call it regenerative agriculture, but is that what you're looking at on your farm as well?
Yes, yeah, certainly I'm transitioning to regenerative livestock management practices. And that's possible because I have, you know, I can do that a little more quickly than on some other farms because I do have off-farm income. But the hope will be that as people start to take a greater interest in their food, they're going to want to see their food labelled so that they know what was the system under which this food was produced. And since Australia's been colonised in terms of cropland, it's lost 50% of its soil organic carbon. And with that loss of carbon, we're also getting poorer profiles, particularly of minerals, so that our plants, they may grow quickly, but they're not necessarily going to have that lovely, dense concentration of important nutrients.
Dr. Alders, this is Sandro. I'm joining the team today. I just had a question. I mean, how important do you think, or how have you seen it done well, of engaging kids, young people, in these conversations about soil? I mean, soil is pretty complicated, but then I've just watched Costa dressed up as the garden gnome having these very basic, you know, really insightful, clever conversations with, you know, seven-year-olds about soil. They seem to understand way more than I do. I mean, how important is it for us to be having these conversations with young people about soil, about regenerative agriculture, about where our food comes from, and the critical links with our natural environment?
It's critically important, very important to get them young and to keep their minds open. In the past, our education systems tended to sort of narrow what we look at. So children see the connections, and it's important that they continue to see connections to ask those questions. And the great thing about children is that they do love to get in and get dirty. Getting those dirty fingers and toes is fabulous. And for the schools that are able to support school gardens, for children to be actively engaged in growing those products, in seeing the cycles, and in understanding what's the right season for this product, as distinct from having something come out of cold storage so that you can eat it at any time of the year.
Yeah, and I was just thinking about schools and, you know, how we think clearly schools are a wonderful place where we can actually engage kids in learning. But sometimes, and I'm just thinking about, you know, when we've looked at schools and done research, the programs are so diverse, and schools, we would, you know, have been in the media for quite some time now around, you know, all the different expectations that are placed upon them. And it is really very tricky to take on board another project. And so we need to be thinking about how can we support schools to do this work. And the organisations who are working into schools are fabulous, but they're not in every school, and their gardens aren't in every school. And we need to be thinking, if that's something that we want, how do we go about supporting that and developing it?
Yeah, teachers are asked to do so much, aren't they? Love our teachers, but sometimes it probably relies on an interest that a teacher has, and that's what you find your child might be, gets that extra kind of lesson in.
Yeah, and often also, I mean, we know that wealthier urban schools tend to have better access often to these sorts of opportunities. So I think it is a good point. Like, how do we make sure that particularly producer communities? I spend a lot of time travelling through regional Victoria and have conversations with communities that are producing most of our food, but, you know, very often at the same time are facing the highest levels of food insecurity. So you've got kids, you know, struggling, growing up in households that are producing food but struggling to be able to afford good food. And I think these are conversations that need to be had more deeply as a country. And thank you to our researchers, you know, including Dina and Robin. And I think it does start early. It requires that joined up conversation of not just what are the calories on the plate, but how do we want our food system to look, and how do we make sure that all Australians, particularly young Australians, get the best possible start in life when it comes to good nutrition and access to good food?
And Dr. Robin Olders, you also look at the gut microbiome and the role of food there, because that's another emerging area that we're talking about more from a health perspective.
Yes, I should say I read the literature on it. I don't do the research in that area, but I do understand how fundamentally important it is. And across the globe, as researchers look at the composition of the different types of bacteria in particular that grow in our digestive system, what we see is that the profile of the bacteria varies depending on the diet of the individuals. And some lovely work that was done around 10 years ago now looked at the gut bacteria of the Hadza group in, still a traditional hunter-gatherer group in part of Tanzania, and they saw a really significant difference between the profile of those bacteria and what you see from people in this particular case. They were looking in Italy, but if particularly people that are living in urban areas and tending to eat more of a processed diet, and what they found was in the hunter-gatherer diet, a lot, a higher profile of good bugs that are going to make us feel a little happier, and also greater stability of those profiles compared to what we see in urban populations.
And this is a great example of where we've understood more, you know, that food is more than just calories or nutrients or vitamins, because actually it's not just about the apple, it's about the billions of bugs living on the outside of the apple that, if we don't kill them in the process of, you know, packaging and transporting the food, are so important for building that microbiome in our guts, which has all sorts of benefits for our immune system, for our mental health, for our cardiac health. We're realizing more and more that actually the kind of soup of trillions of little bugs in our gut are inextricably linked to every part of our health, and that diversity in our diet leads to diversity and health in our gut.
Dr. Robin Olders, thank you so much for joining us. She's a honorary professor with the Development Policy Centre with ANU and farmer based in the New South Wales Southern Tablelands. Eva is joining us very quickly. Eva Clary from Oz Harvest, part of the Little Food Festival and Feast Education Coordinator, and that stands for Food Education and Sustainability Training. Hi, Eva. I really wanted to ask you about food waste and how you teach kids about food waste as part of that food systems approach.
Yeah, thanks for having me. So it's a really cool part of our FEAST program is teaching students about food waste and the astounding stats that we have around food waste in our country and globally as well, and how it really feeds climate change, because when our food waste ends up in landfill, it produces methane, which is a really toxic greenhouse gas. And so it's a big focus to try and allow kids from a young age to understand that food waste is having a massive impact on our environment. And allowing them to understand that they can help that. So the biggest thing that we can do is, as individuals, to stop our food waste, because a third of all food that gets wasted is actually in our homes. So giving them something hands-on and feasible that they can really do.
I think that's a great place to start about what we're throwing away.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge part of food waste, and I always remember the stat. If you think about the scale of food waste and its links to carbon emissions globally, if food waste was a country, it would be the third largest emitting country in the world after China and the US. That is how much emissions, global emissions, are created just from food waste. So this cannot be a more important, conversation about environment, and then of course cost. If we the more food we waste, the more food that's not being used in the food system, and driving down costs and improving access for more Victorians to be able to enjoy good food.
Eva, how do we not scare our kids about food waste?
I guess it's the education of allowing them to understand what they can do to help. And there's really little things like it's just like using up your leftovers in the fridge and checking what you have already in your fridge before going to the supermarket and buying excess of what you don't need. Like, I think just being realistic about little steps and little things that we can do to help them to understand that it's definitely a huge issue, but it's something that we can all help with.
Eva, thank you so much. I can hear you with kids in the background at the festival over at Fed Square. Eva Clary there from Of Oz Harvest. We are out of time. It's been a fascinating conversation. So thank you to our guests here in the studio, Dina Leahy, Associate Professor, School of Education, Culture and Society at Monash, and of course, Dr. Sandra DeMayo from Vic Health.
Thanks so much.
What a great conversation. My name's Kirsten Diprose, and I'll join you tomorrow where we'll be talking about an increase in people holding two jobs.